Chapter 89. Bill Stenzeth listened to the deep rumble of the icebreaker's powerful gas turbine engines, then nodded at the narwhal's helmsman beside him to get the big vessel underway. As the ship slowly began to bull its way through the ice, Stenzeth stepped out onto the frozen bridge wing and gave a friendly salute to the Santa Fe, still positioned in the ice a short distance away. Standing atop the sail, Commander Campbell returned the gesture, then prepared his own vessel to return to the depths. The Otoc turned and forged its way through the ice toward the Numa submersible, easing to a halt just alongside. A pair of crewmen were let down onto the ice, where they attached a lifting cable to the Bloodhound. A large swing crane then lifted the submersible aboard the icebreaker, depositing it in a tight corner on the stern deck. In an adjacent, unheated storage shed, the bodies of Clay Zack and his dead security team mercenaries were laid out, wrapped in makeshift canvas body bags. A short distance across the ice, a polar bear stuck his head over a ridge and observed the operations. The same bear that Giordino had nearly awakened, he stood and stared at the icebreaker with annoyed disturbance, then turned and padded across the ice in search of a meal. Once the Bloodhound was secured, the icebreaker moved on again, breaking into open water much to Stenzeth's relief. The ship steamed west, on a tack through Queen Maud Gulf and on toward the Beaufort Sea. The Santa Fe had by now slipped under the ice and trailed the icebreaker a mile or two behind. Stenzeth would have been surprised to learn that by the time they'd leave Canadian waters, there would be no fewer than three American submarines sailing a silent escort, while a bevy of long-range patrol aircraft monitored their progress high overhead. Along with Murdoch, Stenzeth enjoyed the opportunity to command a new vessel. With his own crew from the Narwhal and most of the Polar Dawn's crew aboard, he was surrounded by able assistants. The icebreaker's former crew was safely under guard below decks, watched closely by the Santa Fe's SEAL contingent and Rick Roman's commando team. Almost every man had wanted to sail home on the icebreaker as a show of retribution for the ordeal suffered at the hands of her crew. Once the ship was free of the sea ice, Stenzeth turned toward a noisy congregation behind him. Crowded around the chart table with his bandaged leg propped up on a folding chair, Pitt sat sipping a hot coffee. Giordino and Dahlgren were wedged alongside, wagering over the contents of the thick leather logbook that sat at the table's center. "Are you going to find out what's in the Erebus log or continue to torture me with suspense?" Stenzeth asked the trio. "The captain is right," said Giordino, who, like Pitt, had an assorted array of bandages taped to his face. He gingerly shoved the logbook over to Pitt. "I believe you have the honors," he said. Pitt looked down with expectation. The Erebus logbook was bound in hand-tooled leather, with an etching of a globe on the front cover. The book had miraculously received little damage from the black powder explosion, showing only a few small burn marks on the binding. Zack had held the logbook opposite the powder cask when it exploded, unwittingly protecting it with his body. Pitt had found the book wedged in a step beside his mangled corpse. Pitt slowly opened the cover and turned to the first formal entry. "Going to build the suspense, huh?" Stenzeth asked. "Cut to the chase, boss," Dahlgren implored. "I knew I should have kept this in my cabin," Pitt replied. With prying eyes and endless questions, he gave up thoughts of digesting the journal chronologically and skipped to the last entry. "April 21st, 1848," he read, silencing the crowd. "It is with regret that I must abandon the Erebus today. A portion of the crew remains in a maniacal state, imposing danger to the officers and other crewmen alike. It is the hard silver, I suspect, although I know not why. With 11 good men, I shall embark for the Terror, and therewith await the spring thaw. May the Almighty have mercy on us and on the ill men who stay behind. Captain James Fitzjames." "The hard silver," said Giordino. "That must be the ruthenium." "Why would it cause the men to go crazy?" Dahlgren asked. "There's no reason that it should," Pitt said, though an old prospector told me a similar tale of lunacy that was blamed on ruthenium. The crew of the Erebus faced lead poisoning and botulism from their canned foods, on top of scurvy, frostbite, and the hardship of 3 winters bound on the ice. It might have just been an accumulation of items. "He seems to have made an unfortunate choice to leave the ship," Giordino noted. "Yes," Pitt agreed. "The Terror was crushed in the ice, and they probably figured the Erebus would be as well, so it is easy to see their rationale for going ashore. But the Erebus somehow remained locked in the ice and was apparently driven ashore some time later." Pitt moved backward through the logbook, reading aloud the entries from the prior weeks and months. The journal told a disturbing tale that quickly silenced the anxious bridge crowd. In tragic detail, FitzJames wrote of Franklin's ill-fated attempt to dash down Victoria Strait in the waning summer days of 1846. The weather turned rapidly, and both ships became trapped in the unprotected sea ice far from land. Their second Arctic winter set in, during which Franklin became ill and died. It was during this time that signs of madness began to afflict some of the crew members. Curiously, it was recorded that such behavior was notably absent aboard the sister ship Terror. The Erebus crew's lunacy and violent behavior continued to proliferate until FitzJames was forced to take his remaining men and withdraw to the Terror. The earlier logbook entries turned routine, and Pitt began skipping pages until finding a lengthy entry that referenced the hard silver. "I think this is it," he said in a low tone, as every man on the bridge crowded in close and stared at him silently. August 27th, 1845. Position 74 degrees, 36 minutes, 212 seconds north, 92 degrees, 17 minutes, 432 seconds west. Off Devon Island. Seas slight. Some pancake ice. Winds westerly at 5 knots. Crossing Lancaster Sound ahead of Terror when lookout spots sail at 0900. At 1100, approached by whaler Governess Sarah, Cape Town, South Africa, Captain Emlyn Brown commanding. Brown reports vessel was damaged by ice and forced into sound for several weeks, but is now repaired. Crew is very low on provisions. We provide them 1 barrel of flour, 50 pounds of salt pork, a small quantity of tinned meats, and 1/4 cask rum. It is observed that many among GS's crew exhibit odd behavior and uncouth mannerisms. In gratitude for provisions, Captain Brown provides 10 bags of hard silver. An unusual ore mined in South Africa, Brown claims it has excellent heat retention properties. Ship's crew has started heating buckets of ore on galley stove and placing under bunks at night with effective results. We make for Barrow Strait tomorrow. Pitt let the words settle, then slowly raised his head. A look of disappointment hung on the faces of the men around him. Giordino was the first to speak. "South Africa," he repeated slowly. "The burlap bag we found in the hold. It was marked Bushveld, South Africa. Regrettably, it supports the account." "Maybe they're still mining the stuff in Africa?" Dahlgren posed. Pitt shook his head. "I should have remembered the name. That was one of the mines that Jaeger checked out. It essentially played out some 40 years ago." "So there's no ruthenium left in the Arctic," Stenseth said soberly. "Nope," Pitt replied, closing the logbook with a look of defeat. "Like Franklin, we've pursued a cold and deadly passage to nowhere."